This is the review session from December 15th, 2005. And you found it. Good. Welcome. And we'll do it in the usual way. Some of you may have had questions about weather and other stuff, and I've had a couple of people ask about taking the exam early, and we can't make arrangements to do that. So the deal is it's at noon tomorrow, and you're already in town, so you don't have the kind of problem that people who are expecting to drive up tomorrow morning from Connecticut have. So you got my email that said, come up today, so you're here. Good. And the way we will work it is that if people aren't there, all they have to do is tell me that they're not there because of the weather, and that's all I need to know. I don't want any more details. I don't want to. And that's why you're here for a review session. Right? Good. Everybody stressed? Tired? Gonna get a good night's sleep tonight? Good. Eat a good breakfast, have a nice brunch, and then after the exam, plan a nice supper. And then hang out till Saturday morning. How many of you have an 8 o'clock exam tomorrow? In the morning? And a noon one. How about a 4 o'clock afternoon one? How about an 8 o'clock one tomorrow night? I think maybe there aren't any 8 o'clocks tomorrow night. There are 8 o'clocks other nights, because I was talking to one student that had one at 8 o'clock this morning and one at 8 o'clock tonight. Okay. What do you need to know? What do you want to know? Yes?
Do we have to be able to define aircraft?
You should know that the question is whether you need to be able to define the 8 stages. By that, you mean list them in order and define each. Julie or I did come up with a wonderful essay question that we chose not to ask, which was pick one, describe the psychosocial issue of that stage, and then explain why that is the issue of that stage. But that goes a little beyond what we did in the course, so we're not asking that question. It would be appropriate to know essentially when the various stages come and what the issues are, so that you would recognize them. But I won't ask you to list the 8 in order and define them, but you should have a general idea of when the various stages occur. And you should generally know what Erickson's about. But you already did. So you already knew that. Do you need to know the overview section? In what sense?
All of those.
All of the transitions and events. You don't have to know them in the sense that you could reproduce them all as I had listed them. What I was doing. In that was illustrating how you would put together your information about each of the 3 domains, so that if you were presented with a particular event or transition anywhere in the lifespan, you would be able to figure out how each of the 3 domains might be involved with that event. So you should be able to do that with any event that you might come up with. So you should understand that process. You know, how you're going to put all 3 domains together. Strange noises happen in this room all the time, so I wouldn't worry about it. The Sodexo kitchen is above here, so sometimes they roll big carts across the tile floor. Sometimes machinery goes bump in the daytime. Is that enough? The individuality force and the togetherness force. Notice I have to walk toward the blackboard to do that. And that's from who?
Bowen.
Right, okay, good. Got that one. Bowen proposes that because we are individuals and because we're social animals, we are driven simultaneously to be separate, and work on our individuality or our autonomy. Those are all synonymous terms. And be self-determining, to be able to stand on our own feet, to be able to make our own decisions, to have our individuality recognized by other people and be respected as individuals separate from other people. So for example, we're not defined by our parents. So you have your own individual personality. At the same time, he says, we're driven by a desire to be together, to be joined with other people, to have relationships. In some of his writing, he refers to that as relatedness. So he says the paradox of being a human being is that you're trying to satisfy both of those at the same time. And what that means is that we approach other people, we try to create relationships with them. That's the togetherness part. And then occasionally, or at the same time, we're also trying to maintain our individuality. And the implications of that are that as we're trying to satisfy both of those at the same time, we're trying to be together, we're trying to have enough relatedness and enough autonomy so that we feel comfortable. And he says then that we have, as we grow up, we develop a zone of comfort, of relatedness and separateness. And as we look at relationships, if we're within a relationship and we're not joined enough, in other words, if we're too individual, that makes us anxious and we worry about not being related enough. If we get too related, we begin to fear for our individuality. And both of those make us anxious. So we feel anxiety when we feel like we're being smothered by the other person and losing our individuality, our individual identity in the relationship. And we're also likely to feel anxious if we don't feel related enough. So we bounce back and forth between those two. And occasionally we crash. That wasn't intentional. So we try to stay within our comfort zone, creating a relationship that has enough togetherness and enough separateness so that we're satisfied in it and we don't get anxious. The problem is that if you're in a relationship both people are trying to do the same thing, and that's okay if they can find a relationship that, a way of relating to each other that keeps both of them in their comfort zone. And the difficulty is that people's comfort zones often don't match. So some people want more togetherness than others, some people want more separateness than others. And the issue then for that couple is that there may be a very narrow range of behaviors that keep both of them feeling comfortable. And it's a constant negotiation in a relationship to stay in that zone. And what happens in the relationship then is if one person is comfortable being separate, it may be too separate for the other person. So that person gets anxious and tries to pull the other person more into being related. And that may be a problem in the relationship, because the way we try to pull people in may be in a way that makes the other person uncomfortable. At the same time, what may be appropriate togetherness for one may be too much togetherness for the other. So that person will try to pull away to get back into her comfort zone, and that will, the pulling away will threaten the relatedness that the other one feels and make him anxious. So we're in potentially in a constant push and pull to try to keep both people comfortable with the degree of relatedness and the degree of separateness. And in HDFS 60, we explore a little more thoroughly the behaviors that people use in relationships. That goes beyond the scope of this particular course. But if you want to go into relationship skills, that kind of stuff, we'll do that in 60. Something to look forward to. Yes?
Is that the person's idea of enduring
sameness? Mm-hmm. Would I?
Enduring sameness?
Yeah, but what were the word or two before that in your sentence? I just wasn't tuned in yet. Would I talk about it? Would I explain it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's all. I often catch what the question is about, but not where it started, so I'm not sure what to do. Erickson uses the phrase enduring sameness to describe what he means by a sense of identity. And what the adolescent is trying to do as identity becomes an issue, what the adolescent is responding to is the awareness that pieces of his or her life don't hang together, that they're inconsistent. And you remember from the discussion of cognitive development, the ability to see abstract similarities and dissimilarities, or isomorphisms. And that's what Erickson is describing, that we become aware that what we say and what we do may not match. We become aware that how we feel and what we say may not match. We may not be representing ourselves consistently. What he's describing as part of the search for a sense of identity is to try to understand yourself and behave in ways that are consistent, so that you create for yourself a sense that you are the same across the various relationships and across the various aspects of your life and across time. Okay. You change when you hit puberty, you change as you develop abstract thinking in adolescence, and that separates you from your childhood. So part of the challenge is to figure out, how am I the same person that I was when I was a child? And then, how am I now? And then carrying that into the future, which your intellectual skills begin to let you do, how am I going to be the same person in the future if I'm no longer in high school? Or if I'm no longer living with my parents? Or for you, if I'm no longer a student? I am going to be the same person, right? You are going to be the same person out there. And what's the continuity? And what's the connection between what you're doing now and what you're going to be doing later? If you're going to have a significant relationship out there when you're 25 or 30, how's that connected to how you're behaving now? So for Erickson, that notion of enduring sameness is what the phrase he uses to try to capture that sense of everything hanging together, past, present, future, all my relationships, that in all the various aspects of my life, they're all different, but it's all me. It's all me. I endure. I am the same person across all my relationships and all my time, and eventually that I'm consistent across those. So that different people relating to me see me fairly similarly. And as you experiment and you think about your relationships and you have more experience through adolescence, that's what you're after, that sense that it hangs together. The other side of that is identity diffusion, which is the feeling of fragmentation. Holy smoke, this doesn't all hang together. I'm different today than I was yesterday. How do I make sense out of that? Or I'm not the same person at work as I am at home. And that awareness that you're not the same is what makes people, as they go through adolescence, anxious and leads to the crisis occasionally of, who the hell am I? That's a quote from Erickson. Who the hell am I? And what you're after is that sense of enduring sameness. What else?
Moratorium.
Erickson's notion is that as we explore relationships and activities and ways of being, kind of working toward that enduring sameness, that it's helpful and important for us to have the opportunity to experiment, to try things out, to follow hypotheses about what might feel good, what might work well for us, how behaving might be, how we might behave in a way that makes us feel consistent. And the moratorium notion is that people should be encouraged and allowed to explore and to experiment without getting caught in permanent commitments or things that foreclose their identity. So there should be some tolerance and forgiveness during adolescence as people are exploring. And that's a moratorium. A moratorium is when you don't make any permanent decisions. The problem with that is that society often expects you to make permanent decisions. People start asking you when you're 15 what you want to be when you grow up. And the appropriate answer to that is, how the heck would I know? But parents and sometimes teachers aren't really comfortable with that answer. But if you follow Erickson's advice, parents and guidance counselors and other people would say, yeah, what are five things you might want to do when you grow up? And how are we going to explore them? And let's figure out what you're doing. Let's figure out what the exploration is. And let's try this for a while. And if that doesn't work, if that doesn't feel good, then we stop. So the problem with identity is that it's okay, in Erickson's view, to explore and to be in a state of moratorium, of exploration, and happily trying out different things and different ways of being. But the society is often saying, no, you really have to make some decisions here. You have to choose a major when you apply to UVM when you're 17. It surprises me that 90% of the applications don't come through undecided, which is the appropriate thing for most of us when we're 17. I'm undecided, right? So, but people put down things and then worry about having to change them. The nice thing about colleges is that we're a place to have a moratorium. You can get away with not having a major for the first year and a half or two without much penalty, depending. Makes your parents anxious. And everybody else around you. It always seems like everybody has a major and they know exactly what they want to do. Don't believe them. They really don't know what they want to do. It's okay. Or they'll change their minds. Better they change their minds when they're sophomores than when they're 30 and have been spinning their wheels for a few years. The moratorium is a period when you don't have to make any permanent commitments. The period of exploration and active search for that for that sense of sameness and the notion about what kind of person you are, but without a lot of anxiety to it. It's not synonymous with crisis. It's not synonymous with anxiety. It's a nice, in my view, it's what college and adolescence ought to be about, of exploration and trying things out, keeping your options open, exploring, and eventually things will fall into place. Other? Language, which I used as the bridge into psychosocial, is on the test in a very, very small way, and in that way is connected to psychosocial development. But there's not a whole bunch about language on it. I felt obligated to include it. So I did. How physical development and cognitive development affect psychosocial. Why am I laughing? That's the 2-hour lecture I didn't give because we ran out of time. 3-hour lecture. That's really the heart. And it's what at the review session yesterday, I asked Julie to remind me that she needs to force me to spend some time at the very end doing more than telling you to, I'm elaborating. You didn't know I told you all this, but she thought she forgot. As I was elaborating on it for myself, that what I did in the final overview was say, here's the way you put them together, and I left you to do that. You've got these three domains, and now you get to try to figure out how to put them together. And I could spend a little more time looking at how that happens across the different stages. In a nutshell, you have a body, and it keeps changing, and you figure out how to use it, and you work at using it in different ways, from learning to crawl when you're an infant, learning to walk, learning to talk, figuring out what to do with your pubescent self, figuring out how to deal with menopause, what that means for you, figuring out, and this is a quote, paraphrase from Erickson's wife, who said at 90, the real problem of old age is trying to figure out how to keep it all together. And I'm reminded by, I also had an email from my mother's 96-year-old cousin about all the things he has to do in the morning to get himself together. And you know, he's got to make sure his electric wheelchair is charged up. He's got to get his shoes on, which is not an easy task for him. He's got to figure out how to get to the kitchen because his knees don't work. And he's got to get his teeth in and, you know, all that stuff. So you're holding it together. So the point is that you have this body that's changing and challenging you your entire life. At the same time, you have a mind that's thinking and understanding things. And that's changing through your whole life. And the changes in your mind are affecting how you understand your body and what you can do with your body and what you try to do with your body. The changes in your body are underlying the changes in your mind. The brain is changing. And that allows you different kinds of thinking, and we think of that in childhood and adolescence. As the brain grows and develops, and the brain is the biological part, then your thinking changes. But later in life too, as your body is changing, your thinking is changing, as your brain changes, particularly if it's deteriorating in any way, or if you're unhealthy, your thinking is changing. So both of those are happening simultaneously, and they're affecting each other constantly. It's a transaction. Then you take that body and that mind and put it in interpersonal relationships. And I guess there are really two main parts to the psychosocial. One is the psycho, not in the sense of psychotic, but in the sense of understanding yourself and self-esteem and self-concept and how you feel about yourself, which is a function of your mind, but it's really talked about in the psychosocial section. And then you have the social part of psychosocial. You're in relationships from the time you're born. And actually your parents start that relationship even before you're conceived, as they start to figure out what kind of person you're going to be. And then you fool them when you're born. But you're in those relationships, and those relationships are in part determined by what your body is doing. From the very beginning, whether it's male or female, shapes the relationships you have with everybody in your life. We live in a gendered world. Boys and girls are different, and they're seen differently, and we relate typically differently. People relate differently to us. So that whole set of social relationships that we have is in part dependent on the body that we have. And then people respond to infants differently than they respond to preschoolers, differently than they respond to middle school kids, differently than they respond to adolescents. As your body changes, your relationships change. As you become an adult, your relationships change. As you go through menopause or into old age, your relationships change. Physical disabilities change your relationships. Yeah, so you've got all of those pieces connected between the body that you have and what it can do and your relationships. And then if you think about the intellectual changes, they also change your relationships. As you're thinking about your relationships, you're behaving with other people on the basis of your understanding of yourself and them. See, I can do that in 5 minutes. And then there's the other side of the question. You asked only about how the biological and cognitive affect the psychosocial. the other side of that is how does psychosocial development affect biological and cognitive? Okay, so that's a transaction too. So you have all three domains influencing each other. So as that would happen, the way you behave interpersonally influences how you think. The kinds of relationships that you have influence how you think. Both Piaget and Vygotsky and other people who are mentioned in the text argue that your intellectual skills develop in your social interactions as children. And the obvious example of that is that if nobody's talking to you, if nobody cares about talking to you and they're not relating to you as an infant or a toddler, language is going to be pretty hard to develop. If people are not taking you into the world and explaining things to you and helping you have experience, so if that relationship stuff between parent and child or caregiver and child is not happening, then your intellectual skills aren't going to develop. So there's that influence early on in life. And then later in life, you know, one of the things that we said at the end of the cognitive development period was that if you look at people who maintain their cognitive skills in later adulthood, their social relationships are important. And particularly having a spouse or partner who is of a high intellectual ability. So the nature of the relationships affects your thinking. And you could go on and elaborate that. Biologically, interpersonal relationships are the greatest source of stress. So the things that are going to stress you in life are other people and your relationships with them. Yeah. Go back to Bowen. Look at the difficulties in Erickson's framework of developing intimacy, an intimate relationship. Look at Sullivan. You know, all of those are about relationships, but they're all talking about anxiety. They're all talking about stress. And chronic stress is detrimental to your physical health. So you're getting those transactions between the relationships that you have and your physical health in both directions. Okay. So that's really the point of the course. Did I say that at the beginning? The point of the course is that we took apart people and we talked about the three domains. And then at the end you get to put them back together, but they all relate to each other. And they all influence each other, but it's hard to talk about those influences until after you've kind of tried to differentiate the parts. Then you can ask that question. Until you've differentiated it, the question doesn't make any sense. Once you've differentiated it, then the answer becomes incredibly complex. But that's what I hope people have carried away from the class.
Will that be on the test?
Did I promise this already? I think I promised, right? Yeah, sure. I couldn't finish the course without asking you to talk in some way about how all three domains relate to each other. Right? Of course I couldn't. Did I end the others last time? Biological and cognitive, how they relate to each other? So what would be reasonable as a question for the final exam? You could probably write it. Right? How would it go? Put you on the spot. How would that question go?
Just as we were stating earlier, like how is psychosocial development influenced by a biological system?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to specifically. How are they all?
The words I would use would be interrelated, or how do they mutually influence each other, so that you're thinking transactionally about all the possible directions. And then rather than talking about it in the abstract as I just did, what would I add to that? Remembering the other two exams. Give and... Yeah, give an example. What would I put after give? And explain. Right? That would be a reasonable question, wouldn't it? If I were thinking about the whole course. That would be... I don't want to give up, you know, too much, but you did come to a review session. Yes?
This would be still
what
there's four essays, choose three.
Yes. Yeah, four essays, choose three. We had a short debate. Julie won. I wanted to do 5 out of 7. No, I didn't. We have to have grades in on Monday, so... We'll both be crazy by then anyway, if we're not already.
So this is out of 4 points. Are there more multiple choice questions?
No. There are 3 out of 4 questions, still 10 points each on those, so there are 30 points in the possible in the multiple choice. Of course, you know nobody ever gets tens. I said multiple choice, didn't I? I'm glad you caught that. They knew that I was talking about essays. And there are 78 multiple choice questions. The other two exams have had 50 multiple choice, so this has 50% more. So the multiple choice part is significantly longer. And for two reasons. One is that there's much more material, and twice as much reading as in each of the other units. And partly because I want to give more weight to the wrap-up stuff, the end, because people sometimes have difficulty getting started, and now at the end is a time for you to demonstrate more understanding of the material. So this has more weight than the other two exams.
So are some of those multiple choice questions
going to
be like straight definitions?
Are some of them straight definitions? Some of them are definitional. What I'm hesitating on is the straight. Some of them are, there are more definitional kinds of questions than in the other two exams. Yeah. Yeah.
From the book,
too. Yeah, where I'm hung up a little bit on the straight definitional. I'm reviewing 78 multiple choice questions in my head. I will be crazy by Monday. What there are more questions that give an example and say this is an example of, and then you have to know the definitions and the differences in order to answer the question. I may be confusing things. What are you afraid I'll ask? Random thought. I could smell the fear. I'm joking. I can't smell the fear. Yes? A lot of questions from the book.
The information that wasn't covered in the
A lot. There are questions from the book, from the material in the book, a material that we didn't talk about in class. Not a whole bunch, but there are some pieces, pieces that we just didn't have time to cover.
Can you
And you are responsible for all of that. On the exam?
Yeah, no, I'm not.
Any changes?
Like, does personality change much? I know, like, there was, like, three different conflicting
views. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. Have your parents changed in your lifetime so far? How? Yeah, you nodded. That'll teach you. That's a really neat thing about divorce, that it gives your kids an opportunity to see you as individuals. Both my kids commented on that after my first wife and I separated, that one of the things they appreciated was that they had to relate to us as individuals and could see how different we were. Before, my daughter said, you know, you were just the rents, you know, the parental unit. And I didn't think of you as separate people, but after we separated, and she had to relate to us individually, she had a much more sophisticated and complex view of her parents. She differentiated us and began to see her parents and her family as more complex in good ways. I don't want to put you on the spot, so pass if you want, but have your parents grown up since they divorced? Was the divorce good for them?
Yeah.
They've learned some things?
I mean, yeah, they've both become, I think they've grown up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's often the case, that the relationship is keeping people from being as competent as they could be, and that's one of the reasons we do divorce, is because we're frustrated. Developmental direction is being stymied, and some people use the opportunity of being divorced to figure out how to be a better human being. So there are typically people feel more competent and stronger, particularly women, particularly if they've married young, which you shouldn't do. Before many of us marry before we actually have the chance to live on our own as adults, and that's not good. So don't do it. That's advice from my first wife, who says to everybody very clearly, she's very adamant about this. Make sure that before you make a permanent commitment to somebody that you have proven that you can live without somebody. You can pay the rent, you can call the plumber, you can get your car fixed, you can plan a trip, you can do those things on your own so that you don't doubt that in the relationship and you don't depend on the other person to do those things for you. So you can feed yourself, so you can clothe yourself, do your own laundry, get your hair cut, make your own doctor's appointments. I'm covering both genders now. All of those things should be done. So some of us didn't do that, and we learned to do those things when we're 35 or 40 or 50. The book talks about other changes in personality in middle adulthood. And one of the important sets of changes that it talks about is the differences between what happens to men and what happens to women. The gender differences change as you, and men and women change in somewhat different ways because they're coming from different places as they go through adulthood. Levinson, in his work, which is described periodically through the adulthood section, talks about people's what they're focused on and how they define themselves changes as you go through middle age. early and middle adulthood. He describes how people I guess I would call it personality. What you relate to and how you relate in the world changes. No, it's a great study question. It got you to go to the name index and look up all of them, right, and figure out what they're talking about. And it's a study question. So I just mentioned Levinson, Valen. They all have interesting views, except maybe Peck on that list. Did you try to find Peck?
Not yet.
Julie did. It's not in the book. Okay. It's a list that's been accumulated over the years, and I thought I had taken off the ones that aren't in this book, but she tells me that Peck is not in this book, and I don't even remember who Peck was. Okay, there is a Peck that I'm familiar with, and I know it wasn't that one. So, Helsen is described in the book, and she's done some interesting longitudinal research on women through adulthood, and I like her stuff. But we haven't gone over it, and you should generally have some sense of what researchers are looking at and how people change, how they describe the change. But we haven't gone into detail in them. Levinson, Valent. Valent I like because he's done such fascinating work. And he inherited the Harvard student study, which was a study started in the 20s or 30s. The researchers at Harvard said, hey, we've got this captive group. If we want to study people across the lifespan, let's take these privileged people, because back then Harvard only accepted primarily privileged people. They changed their admissions requirements later and let in poor kids and gave us scholarships. And by the time the 60s came around, they were up there. But they started this study, and they have followed the same men right on up. The original group is dying of old age now, but they've also picked up successive waves of students, and I'm in the third wave, I think. And every once in a while I get a questionnaire, and once in a while I get a telephone interview about my life from the time I was 18, and following me longitudinally, and I'll be in a book someday along with a bunch of other people. Valence also, he added a parallel study of poor men in Boston, and from the studies, those longitudinal studies, he got interested in alcoholism because he found that it was a big problem among the Harvard students as they got older. Alcohol was a major source of problems for them, as it is in every group. Alcoholism is the biggest health problem that we have now that smoking has declined. But alcohol is much more destructive because it destroys relationships. Smoking just destroys your lungs and your vigor and you die, but alcohol destroys your relationships too. So Valent has studied that group of alcoholics and very clear about it. He was here several years ago and it was fun. He said, okay, so you're an alcoholic. You have two options. You either die of alcoholism or you get sober. That's it. It was very surprising in his study that you just followed people out, and if they didn't get sober, they died. I mean, we all die eventually, but alcoholics die much younger than people who get sober. It's interesting. That won't be on the test. Any of those other people I need to talk about? Then I won't. But they're all fun. And they all have written books, and they have long explanations of development across adulthood. And so that's on your reading list for after graduate school. All of those books. This is the introductory course. Yeah. Ah, Sternberg. Sternberg's, what does he call it, triarchic theory? You don't need the, but it, anyway, says there are three major components of love relationships, and one of those is passion, the chemistry, and one is intimacy, the psychological relationship, the emotional relationship. Third is commitment, which is devotion to the relationship itself. And then he describes various combinations of those three, but not everybody has all three of those. What he describes as, what does he call it, consummate love, the epitome. The best love you can have has all three of those and maintains those three. But loving relationships may have only one of those, or they may have two of those in different combinations. So you can have a relationship that's intimate and passionate without much commitment. You can have commitment and passion without intimacy. You can have commitment and intimacy without, you know, just look at all the combinations. And he gives them different names because they create a different type of relationship with different kinds of satisfactions and different kinds of risks in it. But the consummate, the ideal is to have all three of those. And then Shelton adds the fourth for a long-term relationship, and that's compatibility. Because you can have all those three other things and not be compatible. But that's Shelton, not Sternberg.
Do you want us to know the names of all those combinations?
Do I want you to know the names of all those combinations? No. You probably want to recognize and understand the vocabulary that he uses, but and what was going through my head was, do I know them? Because if I don't know them, I'm probably not going to ask a question about them. And I'm so happy that you named all three of the components when you asked the original question. And then I can remember consummate, and I can probably remember fatuous, because I had to look it up in the dictionary. And I could probably remember companionate, which is without passion. The intimacy and commitment together makes a companionate relationship. And
romantic was physical and intimacy.
And intimacy, okay. So the romantic is without the commitment. And I guess the way I would, if I were trying to remember them, I'd try to remember what was left out in each one. But since I'm struggling to do that, you probably don't need to. But knowing the three and how they add up. And then thinking about your own relationships when you develop relationships. You're all too young. Most of you are too young. I'm sorry. You know that was tongue-in-cheek.
Just asking if parents are not discreet and not permanent in
What?
Under the parenting style, it says categories of parents, and then there's not discrete, not permanent, mid-school.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was, yeah. On the website, there is a description or a listing, a category, which is a summary of what's in the text. And we didn't talk about it in class, but it is it's fun stuff to know. What it was the indiscreet, non-discreet, that was throwing me. The point of that is that Baumrind, in her research, identified different types of styles of parenting, and her caution was that you can't typically put people in a particular category solidly and be assured that they're in that category. That's why it's non-discrete. They're not discrete categories; they overlap, and the not permanent part of that means that people change as parents. So their style may change depending on what kind of kid they have, and our styles change as our children change as they grow up. But what she describes is a style, what, for authoritative, authoritarian, permissive, and neglectful, kind of rejecting. And in the text, they describe those four styles of how people are nurturing, how they try to control the child, what their primary concerns are in parenting. And then the text also goes into the consequences, because different styles of parenting lead to different kinds of kids, or kids with different kinds of skills. So you think about the child is constructing a way of relating and seeing the world based on the parenting style. The important thing in one of the important little cautions about those is that people often get hung up on the difference between authoritarian and authoritative. And those are different words, and they're only different in the middle, and they have different roots, and the parenting styles are quite different. So it's important to be aware that the authoritarian refers to a style that's based on a book from just after the Second World War, called The Authoritarian Personality, which is an attempt to explain why Germany behaved so badly, and why people did what they were told without questioning. And the term authoritarian refers to that kind of personality style and that kind of parenting style, that you expect obedience and you don't need to explain things and children aren't expected to question. The authoritative refers to the parent who is actually an authority on child rearing in the right kind of way, who understands that children have different needs, and understands that the parent's role is to help teach the child, and that includes encouraging the child to ask questions and explaining things to the child, but being an appropriate parent. So that distinction hangs people up a lot. They confuse the two. If the authoritarian is bad, the authoritative is good. That's the bottom line. And what I suggested in the reading notes, if you were looking at those too, was to think about those styles across the stages, because what the text does is talk about parenting styles in early childhood, and then it comes back and talks about it in middle childhood and in adolescence, but the text doesn't really pull them together. So it's fun to think about how an authoritative parent deals with kids in early childhood, middle childhood, and adolescence, because the challenges are going to be different. Sort of what the consequences are of being a permissive parent or a neglectful parent. in 60, if you're taking that in family. We'll go into that in more detail, and we'll also talk about what happens when parents have different parenting styles. What happens when you get an authoritarian mom and a permissive dad? What they fight about and what the kids learn to do. You go to the permissive parent when you want something.
In that respect, would that be part of like definitions for multiple choice, or would that be like an essay of what it's about?
The question is, would that be the sort of things that I would put in a multiple choice questions, definitional or examples, or would it be an essay, or the other part of that question is, would it be both? It would, because we didn't talk about it in class, in lecture, it probably would not be an essay question. You want to whisper?
What is important about parenting?
Parenting is an important part of adulthood, yeah. Write me a note.
Okay.
Julie's signaling, and I'm not sure what you... The parenting styles are important. We just didn't cover them. We threw that essay out, didn't we?
Oh,
okay.
Right.
Okay, now I remember. She... I'm sorry. Okay, I know what Julie is nervous about now, what she's signaling about, which is that in the past we have used a question that was specifically about parenting, and and now I'm trying to remember what the essays are.
Yeah.
Okay, we threw that question. I'm sorry, this is a really bizarre time of year for us too, right? And the confusion about essays is that I wrote 4 sample essays and put them on the web yesterday. Okay, so those are up there. And we have 4 essays on the exam, and I have a bank of a dozen or more essays that aren't on this exam, and then there are the study questions, of which there are 20-some. So I have a whole bunch of questions in my head related to this course and to this unit, and keeping them all straight challenges me. Keeps my brain active. But yes, there is not an essay on parenting styles. I didn't say there wasn't an essay on parenting. I said there wasn't an essay on parenting styles. I'm sorry.
What about parenting?
Oh, golly. Whatever we talked about. What do you think you should know about parents? Well, there's a lot of other stuff in the text about parenting that isn't specifically on parenting styles. Right? And there's parenting in every chapter. relating to parents, being a parent, the effects of parenting. Issues about parenting, stresses of parenting. Now they're afraid to ask any more questions because they're afraid they'll confuse me more. The normative crisis model, as opposed to the timing of events model, or the a couple of others in there early on. Trait and typology, something or other. Okay. No, I don't think you need to explain all of those, but the two that I can remember you probably need to know. A little bit about, I guess. The normative crisis model is that group of theories like Erickson, like Sullivan, and to some extent like Piaget, that argue that there are typical kinds of changes that people go through. And Erickson is probably the best model of that because his goes across the lifespan, that there are certain issues that are going to happen at each stage. And the crisis part of it is that you're going to be wrestling with those particular issues. And how life progresses is in part a function of how you resolve those issues. And the alternative that's a developmental model is the timing of events model, which focuses more on when things happen in your life and argues that you're responding to the events that happen, not necessarily to internal that are predictable issues. And that the way to and what the timing of events models argue is that what's really important is what happens to you and when it happens to you, because that's what you're actively wrestling with. So those folks are more likely to look at when you get married or when you have children, and how you respond to that, how you adapt to it, as they're trying to describe different types of lives. If you're an alcoholic when you're young, your life is going to be different. If you get sober, that's going to change your life. If you lose a spouse or partner, that's going to change life. And they argue that the big differences among us are differences in when things happen and what happens to us, rather than how we resolve the kinds of psychosocial issues that Erickson or Sullivan is talking about. The trait people argue that the big differences among us are characteristics that we develop in childhood and adolescence and carry through adulthood. That's sort of the type of person we are. And they typically are personality theorists who are interested in whether I'm shy or outgoing, and that will determine the structure of my life. If I'm neurotic or if I'm healthy. If I'm really confident, or if I'm anxious, those are more important in making us different.
What do you do in answer to the question about certain theorists or relating to theorists or religious theorists?
Would I ask an essay question about particular theorists or a question asking you to relate to theorists? What do you think? How many of you think I would ask a question about particular theorists as an essay? How many of you think I wouldn't do that? It's pretty much evenly split, I think. I really like those people. So, if I spent 2 or 3 days in class talking about a particular theorist and mentioned that person over and over again, I'd be prepared to write an essay on that person. But I like the idea of questions that ask you to relate to theorists. Make a note for next year. Actually, that kind of came up yesterday, didn't it? The review session. Relating to this.
Those two nerds who weren't here and you did the video.
Yep.
One you did about Aston, and what was the second video about?
You haven't watched it yet? You haven't reviewed notes? That's all right. There is no punishment. What was the second one about? Nobody remembers. Well, it could throw you because at the end of the first video, I made a mistake, which I discovered when I converted it to a DVD, that at the end of the first video, I said, and on Monday, we will continue with an examination of Piaget's stages. That was at the end of a lecture on Erickson. That was a thinko. What we really were going to continue on Monday was a discussion of Erickson's stages, which is what the second tape is about. And they are both online. And the exam isn't until noon tomorrow. Technology is wonderful. Brain's full? Stomach's empty? Need to go refresh? Do it. See you tomorrow. Remember, number 2 pencil. Good night's sleep tonight.